Our second reading this morning comes from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16, verses 1 through 13. Let us listen to what the Spirit is saying to the church. Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer.' The manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, 'And how much do you owe?' 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, 'Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, Jesus often taught in parables, which were stories he told. And these stories usually had themes. They were kind of everyday themes. So about shepherding some sheep, about a woman who was looking for a lost coin. And today we hear about a master and a manager. These would all be images that would have been familiar to the people he was talking to at the time. And most of the time, Jesus did not explain his stories. He told the stories and he let people interpret them for themselves. Which leads us to some challenges, especially with today's. Many Bibles label the parable we just read as the parable of the dishonest manager. But I've also heard it called the problem child. This parable might be the most difficult parable in the whole Bible. Scholars debate its meaning, and many come to the conclusion that it's just difficult. Difficult to interpret and difficult for us to accept. One of my colleagues was working on her sermon last night, and she said, "It's okay if I stand up tomorrow and say, I have no idea what Jesus meant, and I don't know what it means for our lives," right? So, in all my sleep-deprived wisdom, I decided to be a great parable to preach on this week. Nothing like a little challenge to make sure my brain cells haven't died. Now, when I was in college, I was working at Geneva Hills, the summer camp that maybe some of you attended or some of your children attended. And a friend and I were writing letters back and forth. This was before really email was a thing. So we'd write each other letters. And somehow this parable came up. My friend wrote and said, "What do you make of this parable?" So every week there'd be a different chaplain, and the poor man or woman I would approach and say, "I have a Bible question for you. What do you make of the parable of the dishonest manager?" Now, some of the pastors would try to answer me right on the spot. And some would say, I'll have to get back to you. And they would go home and they'd look in their commentaries and their resource books and they'd mail me a letter with some information. And each one had a different interpretation of this parable. None of them had the same interpretation. And then after I got their interpretation, I would write my friend and say, now, what do you think about this one? Now that I'm a pastor, I can understand the anxiety the chaplains must have been feeling with my out-of-the-blue question. Because a while back, my dad called me, and he said, Annie, I have you on speakerphone. We're with some friends, and we're talking about the parable of the dishonest manager. What was Jesus trying to say? Oh, man. I couldn't remember any of the multiple explanations I had been given when I was in college. Probably because none of them was completely satisfying. Finally, I told my dad, I'll have to get back to you later. Now, luckily for you today, I was not asked about the parable out of the blue. I had some time to study and research it. And I found a scholar whose name is Kenneth Bailey, who looks at the parable of Jesus, all the parables of Jesus from a different perspective. He is a Bible scholar, but also a sociologist, and he spent time with some tribes in the Middle East, some indigenous people who would have a more similar kind of worldview and cultural understanding to Jesus' disciples than we might have now. So they're a little bit closer to the culture of Jesus. And so he will talk to them. He spent time getting to know them, to understand them, to gain trust. And I would ask them, now, what do you make of this parable? And one of the things that he has discovered is that the things that we focus on are often not the things that these folks focus on. So they have kind of some different expectations of what should happen or shouldn't happen in the parables. And I will tell you right up front, there are scholars who disagree with Kenneth Bailey. So if you don't like what I have to say, that's all right. I'm sure we can find somebody who's a little closer to where you come at from it. But when I read what he had to say, it was so compelling to me, I wanted to share it with you because it is such a difficult, difficult parable. So this sermon's going to be a little more teaching than preaching, but I hope you'll bear with me because, like I said, I found some just very fascinating information about this parable. Now, for us, one of our main difficulties with this parable is the main character, the dishonest manager. We get tripped up there. He's a rascal. He's an unrighteous person. And then at the end, we hear that he's commended for being so shrewd, for being so rascally. His master commended him because he'd acted shrewdly. We hear this and think, now that can't be right. So we look for ways to try to explain it. So one way we explain it is, well, that was the master speaking, not Jesus. Jesus was not commending this dishonest manager. The master was probably also kind of shady himself. So no wonder he was impressed with the shrewdness of this manager. So that's one way we try to come at it. I do think it's the master speaking about the dishonest manager, but I don't think the rich man was a rascal. I think he was a pretty honest person. There's other people who say Jesus was talking there with the commendation of this dishonest manager, but he was being sarcastic. Now, I will say there's a lot of humor we miss in the Bible. There's a lot of times Jesus maybe was playing with people or making a joke, and we miss it because we take it pretty seriously, and jokes just don't translate very well. But I don't think that Jesus is being sarcastic here. Instead, the solution to this problem of the dishonest manager is that he is, in fact, being lifted up as a good example. As Kenneth Bailey found out, it was common in Jesus' time and culture to have an unsavory character be the hero. Instead of being puzzled, the peasants who would have heard this parable would enjoy a story where the little guy beats out Mr. Big. It seems like he's pulled one over on the master. They would have cheered for the dishonest manager for sticking it to the man. They would not have been shocked by this example at all. The surprise in this parable, according to Kenneth Bailey, comes from another aspect of the parable. So there's usually a surprising part of the parable, but it's not that the dishonest manager was lifted up as a good example. Now, it's easy for us to miss what's happening between the manager and the rich man. In our English translation, it seems that the manager has been given one last chance to prove himself. The master says, "Give me an accounting of your management," which makes it seem as if the manager could explain what happened, or he could even fudge the books a little before he got himself in too much trouble to hide what he'd been doing. If he's going to be giving an account, he might have some wiggle room, some way to convince the rich man. But then the parable goes on to say, "Because you cannot be my manager anymore." Now that sounds an awful lot like being fired. Turn in your keys, gather your things, do not pass go, do not collect $200. And that indeed is what is happening. Kenneth Bailey says the manager could be fired at any moment, and as soon as the master decides to fire the manager no longer has any legal power. Before he's fired, he is given the authority to make deals on behalf of the master. He acts on behalf of the master. He can negotiate. But when he's fired, anything he would do is void. It doesn't count. And Bailey says, when the rich man says, "Give me an accounting of your management," it could also be translated, "Hand over your account books." The rich man doesn't want the manager to prove anything. He already knows he's being dishonest. And if he's being dishonest, he could probably fudge the books too. The rich man fires the manager. And here's the surprise. The manager does not try to argue with him. You would expect that the manager would try to argue and defend his position or why his actions were okay. But he realizes he's been caught. But you know what else? The manager realizes something else. The rich man has not thrown the manager in jail, which he could have done. He was being dishonest. Instead, he simply lets him go. The master cares about his behavior. He takes actions to restore justice, but the master also shows mercy. And nobody else knows yet that the manager has been fired. Nobody else knows yet that the manager has been shown mercy because he's not in jail. It's something that's still a secret between the master and the manager. So the manager comes up quickly with a plan. He talks to each of the debtors individually. He calls them in. He doesn't want them to figure out what's gone on. And the rich man, he's been leasing out his land. He's been leasing out his farms, which around these parts we might know about. Just because you own the land doesn't mean you farm the land. So this master has a lot of land, and he has people who are farming the land for him. And you could do it like sharecropping, where you get a percentage of the harvest. Or you could set it up that there was a particular price for leasing your farm. And so it sounds as if he's set up a lease agreement. So the first person owed 900 jugs of oil for the land they were leasing. And another one had agreed on 1,000 bushels of wheat. And then if there's some sort of blight or there's a drought, it's up to the person who's leasing the land to meet with the manager and try to negotiate a deal, to say, "This has been a bad year. Can we cut the price a little?" And the manager is in a position that he can negotiate. But the only way the manager would have the authority to bring in these people, who would probably be quite wealthy based on the big amounts they owed, was if he was acting on behalf of the rich man. He didn't have the authority in himself. He only had the authority on behalf of the rich man. It's not harvest time, so the people aren't expecting to be having this negotiation. So imagine their surprise and their delight that the rich man has decided to lower their debt without even having to negotiate a new price. This would be very good news. They don't know that the manager's been fired. He hasn't turned in his book yet. If anything, they think the manager has negotiated a special Christmas bonus or something. So some people assume that the manager's inflated the debt and he's just cutting off his portion of the debt. So they think part of the way the manager has been dishonest has been kind of padding the price, and so he's giving a discount of what he would have taken. But Kenneth Bailey says any inflation or cut would have been written in the book, and why would the master allow that? Especially since we hear as soon as the master finds out this guy's being dishonest, he fires him. So that's probably not what's going on. Instead, the manager knows that the rich man has been merciful with him. So he plays on the generous, kind nature of the rich man, and he makes deals with the master's debtors. And at this point, all the people of the village are celebrating. What a wonderful man the rich man is, because he has made these deals with them. He has lessened their debt. So the whole village is celebrating. It's a public thing now. So when the manager does turn in the books, the rich man sees what the manager has done. The manager has acted in such a way as to depend totally on the rich man's mercy. He's taken a risk, but at this point, the rich man won't go back on the manager's deals because the manager has built goodwill not only for himself, but for the master. The manager has shown to the whole community that the master is generous. And so when the rich man praises the man for his shrewdness, it's not praising him for his dishonesty. It's commending the manager for being smart enough to trust completely in his mercy. And here comes a feature of a parable that was common for rabbis to make a point as they were teaching. The principle is from the light to the heavy, from the lesser to the greater. So for example, when I was in seventh grade playing basketball for the first time on a team, I was not the best player by a long stretch. And at practice one day, we were all shooting layups, and I was making my layups, and some of the much better players were missing their layups. And the coach called me out as an example, maybe not the best way to do it in my perspective, but he said, "Come on, team, even Ann made her shot." Which meant if even she can do it, you should be able to do it even more. And we see this in some of the ways that Jesus teaches. He says, "Is there anyone among you, if your child asks for a fish, would give a snake instead of a fish? Or if your child asks for an egg, will give a scorpion? If then you who are evil know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to those who ask?" Many of the parables take on this "how much more" nature. And herein lies the key to interpreting this parable. If the dishonest manager solved his problem by relying on the mercy of his master, how much more will God help you in your crisis when you trust in God's mercy? If the dishonest manager realized his salvation depended on trusting in the rich man's mercy, how much more should we as disciples do the same thing? The parable isn't telling us to be dishonest. It's telling us to rely on God's mercy. And that is the way we should follow the example of the manager. That is the way the dishonest manager becomes someone we should emulate. If this rascally, shrewd, dishonest man can have faith in his earthly master, We as disciples can have faith in our heavenly master. If this conniving manager can take a risk and trust the experience of mercy he has received so much as to then spread this message of mercy and debts forgiven to the master's debtors, how much more might we trust the mercy we have received? And how much more might we spread this message of a merciful master? The manager is commended not because he lies or cheats, but because he relies completely, he trusts completely, has faith completely on the mercy of the master to save him. Might we go and do likewise? Amen.